Hello, this is David Gedge from The Wedding Present, and you're listening to the Pantheon Podcast Network.
Hey, I'm Nick DiMatteo, and welcome to Season 6, Episode 23 of Music Is Not a Genre. If you are just listening, you have no idea what's in store other than maybe the title. If you're watching, you can already see that I have a guest with me today, and that's because we are doing Back Talk 3 with Steve Erickson. How are you, Steve?
Pretty good. How are you doing?
Not bad. I'm actually pretty excited for this because this is kind of a first for me. Those of you who know this show know that I tend to do episodes on very large subjects, kind of a macro view of things, a survey, if you will. And for this, Steve suggested something I've been dying to do for a while, which is to focus in on just one album, and which in this case, it's two albums, but that's close enough. And the two albums that we will be discussing today are Tierra Whack's Worldwide Whack and Kim Gordon's The Collective. And I'm very excited about that. Steve has written on some things about those, published something actually about that. Which one did you publish something for?
The Kim Gordon album. I haven't written about Whack.
And yet, despite that, you've done your research on both. And what I love is that we are coming from different ways of researching, let's say, in some ways. And I think that's going to make this a pretty exciting and interesting conversation. So what we're going to do, just to give everybody the format, is talk about Tierra Whack's album, take a break for the usual mid-roll. When we come back, do a little transition connection between the two, and then we will discuss Kim Gordon's album, and then some conclusions at the end before we wrap up. So why don't we get into Tierra Whack's album? For those of you who don't know, Tierra Whack is a 28-year-old hip-hop artist from Philadelphia, my hometown where I was born. And I discovered in doing this research, many of you, and I'm sure Steve, you already know this, that's her real name. I thought it was a stage name because it's an excellent stage name. Man, that's her last name. I love that. She actually went under some other name for a while that was a stage name and was decent, but I think her real name is even better than that. And March 15th, she released this album called Worldwide Whack, which is 15 songs and about 37 minutes. So any first thoughts on this?
First off, I didn't know that was her real name. That's great. Especially having Whack in your name is such a great rapper alias, but it's real. I think it's useful to give some introduction to her. In 2018, she released a 15-song album called Whack World, along with a video. It's really a short film that incorporates videos for every song, and that was what really put her on the map. It was a really unusual project. Every song was just a minute long. The reason behind that was that she posted them on Instagram, and at the time, the limit for video there was 1 minute. So basically, every song has a verse, a chorus, and then goes straight into the next one. And it covers a really wide variety of styles and moods, even in that space. Then she made a big splash. She signed with Interscope. And then it took 6 years for her second album. During that time, she released a couple of singles every year, except I think 2022 was the only year she didn't release anything. In 2021, she put out three-song EPs, all of which are different genres, ending with a question mark. There is rap, R&B, and pop. If she had put all of those together, they would be about half an hour. So that could have been an album. But for whatever reason, the progression of her career is rather mysterious to me, particularly signing to a major label and then not releasing a full-length project for 6 years. There's a very playful quality to her music. She plays different characters throughout Whack World. On one song, she puts on a Southern accent. There's a lot of really childlike imagery, both through her videos, her album, and single artwork. She has a very versatile voice, both as a singer and a rapper. Like, sometimes she does this kind of childlike falsetto, and there's a lot of kind of warped kids' TV imagery in her videos. Like, the video Pet Cemetery shows her with puppets in a cemetery. The video 27 Club is a lot more disturbing with that, where she's a high school cheerleader singing about suicide.
Yeah, that's one of the reasons why I'm excited to get into this album. But I think the backstory on her was really important to hear, partly because I do remember that initial release with the 1 minute songs. I was fascinated by it just simply because of the song length. And it makes sense that she did it because of Instagram at the time. But I kind of lost track of her in the interim, partly partly, I think, because of what you said, which is that it's pretty mysterious career trajectory, yet there must be enough of a buy-in with her, both on her side as an artist and wanting to continue it and do what she does, and on the industry and the label side to kind of, I mean, tolerate's a strong word, but to go along with this sort of plan or lack of plan for releases that she's had, that has at least at this point culminated in this kind of her first full-length album.
Yeah, I thought that she was likely to get dropped by Interscope or just never release a full-length album, given the silence or how little music she released in the past 6 years.
It makes you wonder, and it makes me wonder as just from the artist side, because I know that people say this about non-musicians online, which is that content is king, and that if you're not releasing something, it's very easy for people to forget you. It's kind of intriguing to me that, and I wonder if you have a label behind you and they know that you have a career in front of you, or they believe you do, then is there a little bit more leeway as far as being consistent about releases? Did she do any collaborations in between there or anything else behind the scenes that was keeping her active?
I don't know about behind the scenes stuff, but I looked her up on Spotify and her three biggest songs are all features or collaborations. The biggest one is a song called TD with Lil Yachty, also featuring Tyler, the Creator, and A$AP Rocky. She has a feature on a Beyonce song and also on Melanie Martinez's Crybaby. However, on Spotify, all of those are at least twice as popular as her most popular solo song. The only music she released last year, I think, were the first singles from Worldwide Whack. She released a movie called Cypher, which is now streaming on Hulu, and that really addresses the pressures of fame. It's a pseudo-documentary about her becoming the subject of conspiracy theories and having a stalker, not knowing that much about her as a person. I get the feeling she's at a level where she has enough clout to get a feature on a Beyonce song, but I doubt she's become wealthy from her music. There's a certain kind of mid-level, particularly, I know she grew up quite poor. She said that music got her out of poverty, basically. But at the same time, I have the feeling there's a degree of success that can kind of alienate you from your roots without, while at the same time, you don't have enough money or enough connections to fully protect yourself. I think that's a lot of what Cypher seems to be alluding to and is maybe an undercurrent on Worldwide Whack.
I think you're right. I mean, I think having learned a little more about Cypher, I mean, there are a few things that run through the album, and we're going to get to the album in a sec, but that is one of the things that kind of paranoia and conspiracy and you know, looking over your shoulder. And I think that's an entire episode of just discussing the before and after of fame when it comes to artists and their relations with themselves, the world, people that they knew before. And yeah, I mean, I think she put a lot of that into this album.
Hello, Pantheon podcast listeners. Christian Swain here to tell you more about my experience with Raycon earbuds. Our family now has three pairs of Raycon earbuds around the house, and my wife just grabbed a pair of the Headphone Pros to replace some headphones from a company that was double the price. And yes, she loves them. Now, if you haven't pulled the trigger on a pair of Raycons, or even if you have but you're in the market for another pair because they're just that good, well, now is the time to check them out, because they just launched their upgraded model of the best-selling everyday earbuds. With Raycon's upgraded everyday earbuds, now you also get active noise cancellation, ergonomic design, and multi-point connectivity that lets you pair with two devices at once, new quick charge function, three customizable sound styles, plus awareness mode, available in a variety of vibrant new colors to complement any and all skin tones. I even have a pair of earbuds in a cool green color. I have tried just about every earbud known to humankind, and these Raycons are fantastic. Seriously, if you've been wanting to check out Raycons, there truly is no better time. You're going to ask yourself why you didn't check them out sooner, and Raycon offers a 30-day happiness guarantee. So what are you waiting for? Go to buyraycon.com/pantheon today to get 20% off your Raycon order, plus free shipping. That's right, you'll get 20% off and free shipping at buyraycon.com/pantheon. buyraycon.com/pantheon.
I was really struck that despite the fact that 10 producers worked on it, it has a very cohesive sound. There's a great deal of variety on the album, but it has a very minimal, very stark sound, where often there's just drums or voice. Sometimes there's a bass line, but often even that is just 808s. And there's one sound like a piano, a music box, I think a harp on one song. It's obviously all done on a DAW. You know, it sounds like it could have been recorded in her apartment. And I was very impressed at how she obviously has a sound that she's aiming for, even if she's working with such a large group of people, that it, you know, the aesthetic remains really consistent.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, one of the notes I put down here was, I love the minimalist production. I think as far as the way it's arranged, I'll say, because I have a different comment about the progression of things, but the way it's arranged, there's nothing I'm missing. I don't feel like, oh, I wish this had the bass where there was no bass, or I wish it had more layers. I think the minimalism works, and I think it works partly because there is a decent amount of variation there. I mean, it's 15 tracks and it's not a very long album despite that, because again, you know, she kind of tends towards shorter songs. I found that for me, what made it work, at least, was the fact that there was so much variation, as well as what you said, you know, vocally. I just really forgot what kind of an artist she was because it had been so long since I heard anything from her. She does have a very malleable voice. She comes at it from so many different angles. And whether it's her or someone else who was directing all those 10 producers, there is some type of a vision, not just in the minimalism, but in the desire to want to find some kind of range. Where you have one song that has sort of a flanged chorused guitar that's kind of like emo hip hop, and you have another one that has drums that are more African drums, and then you have an R&B, and it really kind of does go places that maintain my interest. And at the same time, and I feel like, I don't know if this is a strain through a lot of modern music, it's something I've been talking about for a few years now, and that is, there is a narrow band of what I will call dynamism or emotional expression within which many artists these days remain. So you rarely get so super low that it's nothing. And you more rarely get anything above a certain level of expression and being out there. And I think she holds true to that, which is, even though her lyrics go all over the place and the sound and her voice and all of that, there's not a lot of dynamic range. It remains in that kind of middle band of, we'll get a little soft, we'll get a little bit energetic, but it doesn't, especially considering what she was singing about, it's so emotionally intense. There was a part of me that wanted to be like, well, this is the point at which there's a bust out, an ability for her to just say, ah, and just like rip her chest open. And maybe she's got that in her. Maybe she doesn't care. Maybe that's not what she wants to do. But that was the one thing I thought was kind of missing from this album.
Yeah. I mean, to me, even when it's not part of the lyrics, the production really reflects depression. There are a few songs that just sound extremely soft and fragile. And even the most upbeat songs, her lyrics or her vocals tend to sound more upbeat than the music actually does. My biggest issue with the album is that there's a feeling of whiplash to it, where one song will be rather silly, something like Shower Song, and then the next song will seem to come from this deeply depressed space, particularly around the second half of the album when the lyrics really get pretty dark. I think the second song, Misbehave, has an Afrobeats influence. That's the one where the drums really pop out at you. Yeah, there's this kind of overriding sense of depression over an awful lot of recent music, and also a difficulty where the music itself seems trapped by depression. It's not just lyrics about it. And that really, to me, kind of comes through on this album.
That's a great way to put it, that the lyrics can go everywhere, but they're trapped within the music. There's a depressiveness to the music itself. And I mean, you can name check somebody like Billie Eilish or, you know, other people in that strain, where, again, a lot of lyrical range and a degree of vocal range anyway. And the production is really nice. It's lush in an electronic way. But she's, again, somebody who does not break out of that narrow band. And I wonder when you've picked up on this as well. Sure, there are trends in music, and we know that's true. There have been times where mellow music has been the, you know, rule of the day, like in the, you know, maybe mid late 70s, the pop charts had a lot of mellow music. And maybe there's a parallel there as well, because people thought of the 70s as sort of a depressive time in the country. Is it maybe some cultural, social thing where artists of a certain age or from a certain set of experiences are taking from the world that sort of feeling that is, again, depressed in a way? And whether they're aware or not, they're kind of riding it, and it's throughout their entire catalog.
Billie Eilish sticks to a really restricted vocal range, which WAC doesn't. But her song Happier Than Ever, if I'm remembering the right one, has a guitar solo that kind of breaks through and expresses the anger behind the song. And it's like, finally, she got out of, you know, very almost ASMR type singing. There are similar emotions running through a lot of both Eilish and WAC have songs about contemplating suicide. On 27 Club and Tonight, which are the last two songs on Worldwide WAC, it gets so grim that it's really hard to ignore. Like the chorus of Tonight is, I might die tonight.
Yeah. And I noted somewhere that there were a couple of songs earlier on that were starting to allude, I think Numb and Difficult in particular, where she was starting to kind of allude to the fact that there's going to be some darkness on this album, you know, even more so than the first couple of songs. I like the first song a lot. And the second one is, you know, the sound is nice, but they're very kind of, this is what a lot of people do on albums now with their songs is, I'm going to make a bold statement about who I am or who I don't want to be with. And that's the lyrical content. And that can have a darkness to it, but that's nowhere near as dark as she. And there's your Whiplash with three being Chanel Pit, which I thought was a fun song. That's a song I really enjoyed. Really, overall, it's one of my top three or four favorites on the album. And then it goes straight to Numb and the kind of personal confession of an overactive, oversensitive brain on Burning Brains or whatever else you might interpret that as. And then there's a lot of back and forth. And then right at the end, she just lands really heavily with Tonight and 27 Club. And it makes you feel like, you said, this was hiding behind all of the songs, even the songs that seem to be positive.
One thing about WAC World when it came out, I'd never heard a hip-hop project like that before. Not just the one-minute songs, but her putting on all these different characters. She got compared a lot to Missy Elliott at the time, but there's much more. If you listen to Missy Elliott, there's at least a sense that there's a coherent persona behind it. Whereas on WAC World, she's playing basically 15 different characters. And that really came through in the videos. There's this constant shift where in one of them, she's playing a woman whose face is swollen from getting beaten up. But some of the videos are extremely silly. There's an emphasis on authenticity in hip hop. But often what people really mean by that is that they have a bunch of cliches and tropes that they think rappers should fall into. And she really defied all of those. She's continuing to do so. Although Worldwide WAC seems like less of a hip-hop project, she sings at least as much as she raps on it.
Yeah, that's true. And some of it is the singing while rapping, which I enjoy. Then there's some straight rapping, but then there is some actual straight singing. You know, Difficult was an interesting song because when I did an episode a couple of years ago on emo, and I talked about how there's all different kinds of emo, you know, and especially now, and there's been a strain in hip hop of emo hip hop, and it has a sound and a feel that is that, but you could almost categorize half the songs on this album in that sense, where it's not just confessional, but it's darkly confessional. I love discovering things right on the fly, which is what I did with this album. And there was one song where it sounded like she was rapping with a swollen tongue and part of the song, you know, like it goes beyond mumble. It's, I think Numb was it. And it sounded to me like almost like a different vocalist. And then there was another song where she did do the kind of standard, it's been around for 10 years or more, the kind of like intentionally unarticulated, like mumble singing, mumble rapping, which is different from her straightforward rapping, which is different from her rap singing, which is different from her all out singing. So there is a ton of range.
Emo rap kind of became a genre of its own. I mean, it gets called rap, but it was almost always basically singing through auto-tune with the flow. And it had a big influence from pop punk. You wouldn't confuse her vocals with Juice WRLD or Lil Peep. But in terms of the emo meaning, sort of wearing your emotions, especially things like depression on your sleeve, there's definitely a big element of that. In the past, it felt like she used metaphor a lot more, like Pet Cemetery of WAC World is in theory about a dead dog, but it's pretty obvious that she's talking about a person.
Okay. Did she also do the spoken vocals on this album? Were all the vocals hers?
Yeah.
Wow. I mean, talk about malleable, because that was just straight up I forget which song it was where it's like, oh, I like this. I don't know if I like this song. And it's kind of, you know, it's okay. And she was talking with that kind of an accent. And I'm like, wow.
Oh, the intro. I actually don't know about that. That might have been someone else.
Okay. Yeah. Well, either way, that was kind of a neat thing. And maybe that's why, I mean, I think there are two reasons why for me, an album like this is best listened to a song at a time or two songs or whatever. And that is that I go back to my other comment, which is I just happen to prefer more range. If you're talking about an EP that's meant to evoke a mood, or you're doing a playlist and everything's meant to be mellow because you're, I don't know, trying to sleep or whatever it is, or, you know, meditate, that's fine. But I always feel like an album is meant to be, this is me, the artist, at this point in time. And just like with any human being, unless you are actually clinically depressed and that's where you are, or you're just a person who does not emote, we all have our range of emotions and expressions. So I prefer albums that show that range. And I think that was part of what made this hard, not hard, I won't say that, but not the funnest thing to listen through from song one to song 15. And along with that was that kind of whiplash sense where you feel like she's telling us something about herself and that there might be more of a story behind here, but it's hard to follow the story because the sequencing jump cuts from one thing to the next in a way that doesn't have a kind of an arc to it.
Yeah, I don't think the album is particularly well sequenced. I'm not sure what a better song order might be, but there is something really jarring about putting all these moods together. I mean, obviously people are happy one day. People can be in a very difficult place the next. And the sequencing of the album kind of reflects that mixture of moods. But it almost feels like two EPs put together and kind of sliced into each other. Again, I don't know if it would be better if she did an EP of all upbeat songs and an EP of all sad songs, but it feels like she made both and kind of threw them together.
Oh, that's a great observation, because her background kind of is short form releases, EPs, and even the 1 minute album, 1 minute songs. And if this is her first full length album, maybe this is her, like, you know, whoever sequenced it, the best they could do with two completely different things. I'd be very curious to hear that. And it makes me curious to see if something changes whenever the hell her next album comes out, which who knows with her trajectory. But the one thing that popped into my head while you were talking about that, it seemed to me Chanel Pitt might be the exception, but that even the ones that were more upbeat, and Imaginary Friends has kind of a dark side to it because it's like about loneliness, or at least finding comfort through, you know, whatever, but there's a playfulness there, or movies, but there were some songs that sounded fun to me, and it's like the lyrics were striving to be that fun, but her heart wasn't completely in it because of the fact that I think her heart is in a darker place and she was doing her best to kind of get to that happier place, but some of them didn't seem fully fleshed out.
Well, she says she wrote 300 songs for the album.
Oh.
And certainly she'd been accumulating them over the past 5 years. That's possible. But she also said she didn't like most of those songs. There's also a very uncomfortable aspect to listening to the album. She says she's been to therapy. She's in a much happier place now. But she really believed in that concept of the 27 Club and thought that she would be dead. She didn't think she would live to be 28. The final words on the album are, "Coach got me doing suicides." When you hear something like that, as a listener, how should you respond? Particularly because this is also a commercial product released by a major label. And if it makes money for them, they're profiting off of her pain.
Well, yeah. And that's an age-old story. Profiting off of the pain within the song, but even worse than that, the pain within that artist's life. I mean, you can go back to grunge. You could go back to certain 60s artists. You can go back to the blues. And that's just been happening forever. I did an episode on the 27 Club a season or two ago, and it was pretty surprising how many music artists died at the age of 27, even further than the 3 or 4 or 5 that all of us know. And it's interesting that there were quite a few people who hadn't even heard of it. And most of them were either people who weren't that into music or were just younger people. So she's definitely got a sense of history here that she even called the song that. And the fact that she's 28 now means, I guess, there was a little bit of triumph here that she made it through. But It was one of the more interesting songs to me. And, you know, if we were going to recite the lyrics even beyond the lyric you said, I would say fair warning, everyone, when you look them up. But it had that kind of lyric music juxtaposition that I find in artists like, I call it very Smithsy, because it reminds me, not in sound, but in the way they're juxtaposed, of both the Smiths and Elliott Smith, in that there's darkness and negativity within the lyrics, but the music itself there were much darker musical songs on this album than 27 Club. I feel like 27 Club had that difference going for it, that dichotomy.
Yeah, although given how intense the lyrics are, the music, you made this point, the music is not what you would expect to accompany those lyrics.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And I don't know if that was an artistic choice. I love the choice, because if you're writing lyrics like that and then the music is like super, super negative, depressing and down, that's like taking a pill, you know, like that's just too much of the same thing. So there might have been an effort to say, well, I'm going to do these lyrics, but I'm going to frame it in a way that's not going to be so depressing that it's impossible to listen to. So that's Tierra Whack's War Why Whack. There's a lot more to talk about there, and I recommend that you all look it up. Just for the record, some of my favorite songs on it: 27 Club, Tonight. Yeah, they're dark. Movies, Imaginary Friends, Chanel Pitt, and Mood Swings. That's in reverse order because that's how I'm scrolling. But that brings us to the midpoint of this episode. We're going to take a break and we're going to come back with Kim Gordon's The Collective. So stick around. We'll see you in a sec. Hey, so I was going to do the usual and just list all of the links that I'd love for you to check out, but I realized that everything you need to know and everywhere you need to go is at nickdimaddio.com. That really is the hub. I list all the links in every episode just in case, but nickdimaddio.com is where I put everything that I do. If you want to know more about this podcast, whether it's the audio version or the YouTube version, at youtube.com/@musicisnotagenre, or wherever else the podcast shows up, or if you want to support the podcast at patreon.com/musicisnotagenre, just go to nickdimaddio.com. It's all there. If you want to check out my full discography of original music and covers for my band REC, REC, and beyond, it's at nickdimaddio.com, including all the streaming and social links for wherever you listen to music and wherever you check out your soch. My acting clips are there. My voiceover clips are there. Graphic design, my blog, and most especially, it's the best place to contact me. If you go to nickdimaddio.com/contact, or just hit the contact is on every single page, you can send me a note, say hello, ask me any questions you'd like. You get a newsletter a few times a month. And if you have a project of your own and need work done for it, whether it's audio editing or music or voiceover or graphic design, or if you have an event and you need live music, go to nickdimaddio.com, contact me, say hello, let me know what you need. I'd love to hear from you. Thanks for listening. Let's get back to the show. All right, we are back. Back Talk 3 with Steve Erickson. We're talking about two albums today. Tierra Whack's Worldwide Whack, which was a great discussion, and upcoming Kim Gordon's The Collective. What I like about this, again, is because I don't often dive this deep into a single album or two albums, so this is kind of fun. But also, what's cool is there seem to be some connections here, even though you've got a 28-year-old Tierra Whack, primarily from the hip-hop world, and you've got Kim Gordon, late of Sonic Youth, who is 70 years old. There's a 40-plus year difference there, but they're both independent women doing full albums. Both albums they're actually almost the same length. They're just a few minutes off in length, even though there were a few fewer songs on Kim Gordon's album. And I know that sonically, this might not be something that hits somebody right away, but you know, I listened to the production of Kim Gordon's album, and we'll talk a little bit more about that. But I find that there is a level of minimalism in the way that is produced that is different from, but parallel to, the minimalism that Tierra Whack had in her own. And of course, you've got the electronic beats and hip hop influence, even on Kim Gordon's album. Again, The Collective, which was released on March 8th. And the last thing I'll say about this before I hand it off to you is that there's a lot to say, but I'm only going to say this for starters, which is it reminded me of certain lyrical approaches that she took If Lou Reed and Laurie Anderson ever did a project together and weren't just married and asked Beck to co-produce it, it might come out something like this.
That's an interesting combination. It feels much harsher than anything Beck's done. There actually is one degree of separation between Gordon and Wack. Justin Raisin, who produced The Collective, has also worked with Lil Yachty, who did a song with Wack.
That's amazing. Yeah, it again shows how, and this is why I do this podcast, which, by the way, quick note, if you saw my special announcement last week, my sincere hope is that this won't be the last season, but it would very much help to solidify that if anybody out there could give just $1 a month to help to support this. It would make a big difference. Coming back to this, music is not a genre is about talking about music that doesn't seem to have a connection, and yet there is a connection. And here you have, again, two albums from different worlds, different kinds of music, but you have some crossover in the way things were assembled and produced, in the way, you know, in that slight crossover of minimalism and the fact that they are both women doing solo albums and have a pretty large say in what they're doing. And now you have this other one degree of separation with this producer. And it just proves the point that I often try to make, which is things that seem far apart at first glance are not as far apart as you might think. So what is your general take on this album?
Well, if Worldwide Wack is inspired by depression, The Collective to me sounds like it's really inspired by anxiety, but it also, it's a lot less accessible about its emotions. I got an advanced copy for the Arts Fuse Review and the publicist would not. Usually there's the publicists make a lyric sheet available. They didn't do it for The Collective. And I know there's no lyric sheet with the vinyl or CD. There's a lot of words that leap out at you, like cement the brand on the final song, or I won't join The Collective on the Candy House. And yet the production is so noisy that often those are the only words you can make out clearly. Or on Bye Bye, she runs down this list of, the lyrics are incredibly banal, this list of items she's picking up before she's packing for a trip. But there's like a one-note bell running through the song that creates this tension. And she sounds a lot more nervous than she should be given what the lyrics are about. And that kind of runs through the whole album.
You are right. I was trying to think of a word to describe it because I did think there was, you know, neither album is Let's Celebrate Life, you know, and yet this one isn't really depression. But anxiety is the perfect word for that. And I actually really enjoyed that first song, but I was struck by the fact that I didn't really get most of the lyrics on first listen because I was listening in the car not reading. And then when I listened the second time through with the lyrics in front of me, I was like, oh, it's a list song, you know, and there have been list songs like It's the End of the World and We Didn't Start the Fire and a few things that other artists have done where there always seems to be this other intention of saying, well, I don't need to spell out for you that this collection of things that I'm listing means more than it actually does. And yet I'm listening to the song and it's an anxiety ridden sound and the lyrics are banal, like this list of things. And I didn't feel like it was almost kind of Dadaist to me. Like I didn't feel that there didn't seem to be any other ulterior meaning to the lyrics that leaped out at me.
My interpretation is a bit different and it may be completely off from what she intended. But for me, it's a song about the breakup of Sonic Youth, which occurred because of the breakup of her marriage to Thurston Moore, their singer and guitarist who cheated on her. And if you read the lyrics, it sounds like she's packing to go on tour. And then the fact that Bye Bye are the final words, but then the song goes on for another 2 minutes. The guitars get heavier after the lyrics end, and it carries a lot more anger than you would expect given what the lyrics are about. But I think the emphasis on packing to leave, that in some ways it's a reflection on her divorce and the breakup of Sonic Youth and the pressure of starting it. This is her second solo album, but the pressure feeling like you're as a senior citizen starting over musically.
Oh. What a great statement. Yeah. I mean, she is 70 years old. And I mean, I know a lot of 70 year olds and older. And one thing that strikes me about them is that there are those whose voices sound old, and those whose voices don't. And she didn't do a lot of singing on this, but her voice doesn't come across to me as a 70-year-old's voice. The lyrics, I mean, certainly reflect more life experience and things that obviously they would from somebody, you know, like a Tierra Whack, who has her own life experience and expressed a lot of that. But the range of what Kim Gordon is expressing here, the kind of anxieties about, I read a quote of her saying this was about responding to a world that she thinks is crazy right now. And it might be that kind of combination of the world itself is crazy, seemingly more so than usual, but also her own world is crazy because of that breakup. And I'm always kind of torn with songs like this, and honestly with the whole album in general, in that when you're writing lyrics that either seem banal or they're poetic in a cryptic way, and there is not necessarily any indication within those lyrics as to what you're singing about. But then you go and read something that says, oh, well, this song is about this, or maybe repeated listens, it might dawn on you, but there might be something or that the artist or someone else said where, oh, this song is meant to be the breakup of Thurston Moore and Sonic Youth. And then it puts a new light on it. I do think you can get more out of the song that way. But there's this artist part of me, this other part that's like, well, I just want to be able to get everything I need out of this song just by listening to it. I don't want to have to read a dissertation on where it came from. Like, part of that meaning, it could have taken a single line or a word or a half a line that would have opened your brain to say, oh my God, this entire song is about her packing because she's leaving a relationship, you know, or two relationships if you count the band. And it would have had more, even though, again, I liked the song, it would have had more impact for me if that had been inherent in the lyrics.
That's just my theory. She hasn't come out and said that that's what the song is about. But knowing the events of her life, yeah, the first time I heard it, I thought that it was just deliberately trying to, like singing your grocery shopping list, you know, deliberately trying to do something banal. But the fact that the final lyrics are bye-bye and just how angry, particularly the second half of the song sounds, there's definitely something going on there. But throughout the album, I think the lyrics are not necessarily the main way that the album's expressing its emotion. The production, the layers of guitar, synthesizer, drum programming, in a lot of ways, the drums are the lead instrument here. And they're really harsh.
Yes, her voice is distinct enough that I can hear it in my mind now. And I tend to judge things by what I come away with. Like, I have often seen, you know, musical theater or other performances where I'm like, I really enjoyed that experience. I don't remember a single song. Whereas with these, both of these albums, there are things that pop out at me that I will remember. And one would be her voice and her delivery. And then the other two things would be the drums and the guitar. And I know there was more in there, but the impression that is left in my mind is it's this swirling, almost, if you combine noise rock with shoegaze, you know, and then you have the kind of minimalist electronic kind of funky drums with some of her delivery has a slight hip hop tinge to it. That's the takeaway that I got from the entire production of this. And even though I feel like there was a little more emotional range expression wise in the music itself, if not necessarily in her voice, because her voice kind of does that same kind of, I'm saying this kind of delivery. The production itself, I think in some ways had a bit less range than Tierra Whack's production. And sure, it was more cohesive, but I know that she's got a long history and works with great people. And I wondered if that was a deliberate choice to just stay with the, at some point in every song, that guitar is going to go to a place where it sounds like you're holding a chord and then scraping the guitar on a stair rail. And that happened pretty much in every song to some degree.
The liner notes credit a synthesizer and sampler by name, the Ensoniq ASR-10, which I had never heard of until I listened to this. And then I looked it up, and it's known for allowing you to put 5 or 6 different layers of filters. And I think that's a lot of it. It sounds like she's sampling her own guitar playing and then creating loops from that. I have a different feeling about the words. I think that the album for me is really held up over repeated listens. And part of that is because there's something mysterious about it that you're not necessarily going to get on a first listen. Part of the pleasure is if you listen to it 5 or 6 times, you'll start to realize what the words actually are.
Mm. Yeah, that's a great point. Right off the bat to me, when you have a song like Bye Bye, which is just rife with lyrics. And I think that is the kind of thing where you're like, I would almost equate it to, if you're not necessarily high, but if you're in like an altered state, if you're tired or something like that, and you're staring at this pattern on the wall, and it means nothing. But the longer you stare at it, the more you're like, oh my God, there's a face in there. And that face looks like it's telling me to look up to the sky or whatever. You start to find these meanings. And it's like you said with Bye Bye, I love your interpretation of that. I hope other people quote your interpretation because I think that it's dead on. But it is one of those things where you're like, well, I listen, and oh, I came away with this. And you're not even entirely sure if that was the intention. So there's that mystery there. And then you have a song like Candy House, where it had very few lyrics. And yet for some reason, those lyrics got right through to me. As I was the second time through, I'm reading it as I'm listening to it, and I'm like, oh, it seemed to say more with fewer words than the first song.
Hey folks, Stefan Shirazi and Renee Richardson here from the Metallica Report.
And we are proud members of the Pantheon podcast family, where the best of music and podcasts unite.
We've got something pretty cool for you. We're giving away an exclusive Metallica merch package worth over $250.
That's a whole lot of Scary Guys, Skulls, M72, and other sought-after Metallica swag. And we've made it easy for you to win. Follow and share the Metallica Report, and you're in the game. Go to pantheonpodcast.com/Metallica, enter your email, and hit that button to be entered to win.
And just like that, you're eligible for our monthly exclusive Metallica merch package.
And guess what, rockers? You can enter every month, so just do it. And while we love our global brothers and sisters, the lawyers won't let us ship outside the U.S.
At the same time, she's throwing out Easter eggs that I don't fully understand with that song. Its name comes from a novel by Jennifer Egan. I didn't know that till literally 10 minutes before we started recording. I was trying to figure out, what does the Candy House mean in relation to the line, I won't join the collective? And I found a book review of the Jennifer Egan novel, which sounds very complex. And from the book review, I think you would have to read the novel to know exactly what she's getting at with that allusion. But again, throwing in those kinds of references can expand the experience.
Yeah, I see what you mean. That shows, in a way, the benefit of the internet era of music, in that if you're curious enough, you can find supplemental material that supports what it is that you're writing or researching or watching or listening to or whatever it is. And it does, I think, enhance the experience of the songs if you are curious enough to go beyond first or second or third listen to know that information and then listen again.
For me, The Collective is an album that's really rewarded for repeat listenings. I've listened to 2 months at this point, and it's, you know, something that I still listen to regularly, which with these days, with the amount of music coming out every week, that's pretty high praise.
That is high praise. Yeah. For most of my life, I had a car. I haven't had a car for 10 years, but I can say that one of the reasons why I listened to albums 3, 4, 5, 6, 8 times was because I was a captive audience and had nothing else to do but listen to music. And now we have everything else to do. Car or no car, you can listen to or watch a million different things. There is something to be said for, I think, any work, but in particular music, because they're, you know, shorter and more easily digestible than, let's say, an 8-episode, you know, something you binge watch, that if it is compelling you to listen again and again and again, and you may not even be sure why until the third, fourth listen, you're like, this is why this is hitting me, because of the things that I knew might have been in there the first couple listens, but just couldn't quite get right away. It's a credit to, well, you as well, and anyone who takes the time to listen to something more than once.
I'm not sure what to say to that.
I mean, and I think it's partly because I, you know, my production schedule is such that, and the other things I do kind of take precedence, like my own music and other work, that when I am doing an episode on a subject, I'd be hard pressed to listen to something more than once or twice. And I will still say that having listened to both of these albums just twice, now that second time, I'm like, oh, I think I need to listen a third time. And I think that's a real important note for anybody out there who is a music fan who is encountering something that they may not have picked up on their own, because these are albums I probably would have listened to maybe once and been like, all right, well, now I can say I listened to Kim Gordon's new album, but it wouldn't have been on my giant list of this is an album I need to listen to right now. But because we're doing this episode and I took the time and said, well, one listen isn't going to be enough for me to have these notes and some thoughts, and I listen again, it forced me to open up a little bit more. And I'm saying to all of you out there, the first listen, I might have just said, that's enough for both albums. The second listen for both albums, I'm like, I need to listen at least one more time. It doesn't mean I'll listen more than that, but it's making me want to listen again, because there's more to the lyrics and the stories and the meanings and the meaning that happens when the lyrics and music mesh than you're going to pick up in the first one or two or even three listens. And you're somebody who's good at that.
A friend of mine named Jeff Jackson wrote a novel called Destroy All Monsters, which is about a series of murders of musicians happening at live shows all around the world. And what it's really a metaphor for is the way that music has been cheapened by streaming and by just the huge volume that there is out there. One thing I find rewarding about writing about music, typically I listen to an album four times before I finish my review. And that really forces you to come to terms with whatever, to get beyond your initial thoughts. Often I listen to music once and just have no reaction, like, yeah, that was okay, I'm never going to play it again. But if you played it, if you listen to that album every day for a week, you might wind up loving it. That's something that Jeff has said. But in the days when you had to pay $15 for a CD and you didn't have a lot of money, sometimes you would buy albums and he would initially dislike them. But because he spent so much money on them, he would listen to them every day for a week. And some of his favorite albums are actually things that he initially disliked. Whereas now, I think people will even skip. I mean, I do this myself as much as anybody else. Check out a song on YouTube and turn it off after 30 seconds if I find it grating.
God, that's a great point. You know, music itself has an inherent value that is whatever people give it, especially the artists. But culturally, I can say this about any damn thing you buy. If it costs more money and you're a person who doesn't have a lot of money, you're going to attach more value to it regardless of whether you like it. So if you, I bought this $80 sweater and I realize it's not my favorite and I don't have anybody else who wants it, I got to wear it at least a few times to get my money's worth. That definitely happened to me with CDs, where I would listen to things more than once. The first time I was like, I just wasted $15. Well, no, I'm going to listen to it again and again and try to get something out of it. And there is a sense of disposability when something is either super cheap or free, like on YouTube and elsewhere, where you don't have to have any buy-in whatsoever. So it's harder for the artist to get hooks into people because people have no incentive to listen to something more than 30 seconds. And it's harder in some ways for the listener, because then which of that music is going to be the music that you remember 20 years from now if you're only giving it, you know, a second? And you might have missed something that could have been music that you would have taken with you for the rest of your life, but you dismissed it immediately.
Bye Bye has gotten more attention than anything Kim Gordon has released since Sonic Youth broke up. I think that really works as an intro to the album and to her as developing a new sound from Sonic Youth. It's actually gotten some degree of popularity on TikTok. Not that it's exactly a hit there, but you would not necessarily expect a Kim Gordon solo album to get any traction whatsoever on TikTok. And although she didn't make a hip-hop album, and she doesn't sound like she's jumping on a bandwagon, there's a connection to, like, there's a subgenre of hip-hop called Rage. It's an offshoot of trap music, but influenced by both punk and video game soundtracks with really distorted electronics, very abrasive. The vocals are often, or at least the lyrics are often, kind of an afterthought. And there's much more of an emphasis on creating a mood.
Wow. Yeah, that does very much describe a lot of this album. And I agree. I think Bye Bye, even in my notes, I said Bye Bye was a great opener. Great way to reintroduce yourself to the world. I didn't know it was trending on TikTok, though. That's interesting. So any final thoughts on this album?
I don't know. To me, it suggests constructing this might be a strange connection, but I think of Black Sabbath's Iron Man, particularly that distorted voice going, "I am Iron Man," and then the guitar kicking in.
Oh, yeah.
That's not how her voice and guitar sound on this, but it sounds like constructing this wall of sound to try to protect herself or to try to project herself to the world. When I listen to the album, I can almost see this huge skyscraper in the distance or imagine something. There's something very metallic about it. I don't mean heavy metal, but about the way that this cold, harsh, but also very loud, thick sound.
Yeah. There is a harshness, and you're right. It's not a metal harshness. There isn't just a noise element to it. The way you described Rage, I think of certain bands who do noise rock and things like that. There's a level of experimentalism to the sound itself, especially if you're talking about that in Sonic, which my first keyboard wasn't in Sonic. It was an ESQ-1 way, way back. But then filtering and filtering and filtering and just creating this landscape, like you said, that says more, I think, about the overall intention of the album and of her emotions than her delivery does and even some of her lyrics do.
Sonic Youth's first EP came out in 1982. So she's been making music for more than 40 years, and I can see connections to early 80s noise rock and groups like Entities and Neubauten. You can kind of hear in the percussion, but also some very old school hip hop. There was a point around 1984, 1985, where there was a lot of extremely harsh drum programming, like Schoolie D's PSK, to mention Philly again.
Yep.
That's been called the first gangster rap song. But even if you don't pay any attention to the lyrics, the drums just sound flat out evil.
Wow. Yeah, no, that's absolutely true. That's I love that you connected it to Schoolie D and Philly. I mean, wow, that's great. I think before we do final thoughts, I'll just for the record say that some of my favorite tracks on this album are Bye Bye, The Candy House, I'm a Man, Treehouse, The Believers, and Dream Dollar. So I think that's one more favorite than I had for Tierra Whack. So, you know, if you're scoring at home, then I probably liked this album a little more, but for different reasons. That's a little bit hard to say. But I will say my closing thoughts on this. Both albums, for me, had some real highlights and some very interesting choices. I do say that in both cases, I would probably listen to each one again at least once. If I'm going to listen to Kim Gordon's album again, it's going to be with information in front of me, because I'd like to get more from each song than just putting it on in the car or the background and letting it soak in, because I've soaked in the sonic part of it. And I think I need to grab more from it than that. I think both are worth a listen in their own right. But if you're going to do it, take your time, maybe just listen in a few doses and then go back and listen again. That would be my advice. What about you?
Music videos have always been very important to Tierra Whack. She's worked with an artist based in Philly, Alex DeCorte. He drew the album cover for Worldwide Whack, and he also directed the video for Tonight, which is an animation where she's this huge blimp flying above Philly that collapses down to the street. Her visuals are really important and I think flesh out what she's doing. So I would suggest watching the video. I think she's made three videos off this album, Shower Song, 27 Club, and Tonight. And you can see there's a sense of humor even to the darkest moments on the album, where she can imagine herself as a cheerleader performing 27 Club.
Ha! I love that. And that's actually an amazing segue for everyone out there into my episode next week is on music videos. They're not just their history, which goes back a lot farther than you think, but whether or not they matter when it comes to the music itself. And I've always been on the fence about this, and I don't want to spoil next week, but I will say, if what you're saying is in the sense of a Kim Gordon, where it benefits knowing some where she comes from and the backstory and some other things that have happened to her, or maybe the book she read or whatever, that helps to illustrate the songs. For Tierra Whack, you're kind of saying that the visuals inform the songs to a point that goes well beyond what someone could get from them by just listening to them.
Yeah, I mean, Whack World was really designed as a visual album. I think it holds up very well as music. But if it had been released without those videos, I don't think she would have made the splash that she did. I was a lot less impressed with Cypher, actually. But it also says something that she made a feature-length film, a pseudo-documentary about her life.
Yeah, and you mentioned that, and I'm going to watch that at some point. But it kind of also says that, well, I guess she does have a vote of confidence of enough people out there that she could make this film with all the effort that takes and the team, and then to have it show on Hulu. So, right, it's a pretty well-known channel. That's not something that most people can get done. So she's got, I think, enough cachet to where if her next album, full album, comes out in, you know, 2030 or whatever, people will probably still hang on for it.
Yeah. One video is from Tim Gordon's album, I'm a Man, I also thought was quite interesting. It's made by a filmmaker who's directed about five features, Alex Ross Perry. That song to me seems to be about an incel who may be trans. The video shows him peeping on a woman. And then when she leaves the room, he enters and tries on her clothes. And then she tries on his clothes. It takes this very creepy scenario, and it remains creepy, but you expect it's going to go to violence. And instead, it's more about this very screwed up guy, but there's a possibility that he can explore himself, or if he really is trans, for herself, and go to something more positive at the end.
Wow. And yeah, I loved the lyrics to that song, but I did not get that from that. I thought there was definitely some kind of a gender identity thing going there on there, but that sheds a whole different light on it. That's great. So a lot of things for people to explore out there. This has been a really great conversation. I hope we can do it again. Maybe pick a couple other albums and see what happens in a few weeks or months or so.
Sure. Maybe like July.
Sounds good to me. Thanks for being here. And thanks for talking to me about these.
Sure. It was a great conversation. If anyone out there can afford it, join Nick's Patreon, and hopefully we can keep this going for years to come.
Thank you, Steve. That means a lot to me. I really appreciate that. And thank you, as always, everybody out there who is watching and listening. Whether or not you're contributing, that means a lot to me too. Contributing would be great, but it's the, as I say, music conversation and connection that means the most. Thanks for hanging with me. Thanks for hanging with Steve. And stay tuned next week for an episode on music videos, which now will feature a mention of Tierra Whack. Thanks a lot, everybody, and I will see you next week.
Bye.
It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's FantasyPoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. FantasyPoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more Fantasy Points.